Donald on a Kitchen talks about food. Donald on a Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on a Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald on a Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintos.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. And we are here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa. Oh, spring. Well, actually, we're sliding into summer. June berries are ripe and the evening primrose are blooming, Donna. So it's June.
Mm-hmm.
It's June.
Yep. The peonies are done and the hydrangeas are on their way. Yep.
Listen, things change and it's ever so nice to watch things come and go. Well, we're going to figure out how we got to where we are today. How did human beings actually figure out how to cook food? I mean, it's one thing to go out and fill yourself full of June berries, but you kind of need a little bit more of that. So we're going to be exploring the history of feeding ourselves today.
Not a small topic.
Not a small topic, but here to help us along with that. Today in the studio, we have Nick Land. He's a historian, and he markets grass-fed quality regenerative meat. And he's been doing that for a while, too. And he's here to share the fascinating history of cooking with fire. And also maybe to talk about some grilling tips for the summer. Welcome to our table, Nick.
Hi, thanks so much. I'm really glad to be here. I'm really excited to talk to you guys more about cooking and history.
Good, good. Where did you go to school and how did you get interested in cooking and history as a combined topic?
Yeah, so I have a degree in history from the Metropolitan State University of Denver. One of my absolute favorite professors that I had there, Dr. Laresh Jayashankar, he was a U.S. food historian. So he actually kind of engendered my interest in food before I knew I had an interest in food from a historical perspective. He actually wrote a book called Sameness in Diversity that studied how when you look at American history of the the supermarket, you look at a supermarket in the 1950s and it might only have 5,000 items and it was a very homogeneous thing, but you look at a supermarket today and it might have upwards of 15 or 20,000 items. You go to Hy-Vee and not only can you find things that you might have for your American staples, pork chops or ground beef or stuff like that, but you can also now there's a Latin American aisle, there's an Asian aisle, so we might have a more diverse food set now. But at the same time, what he studied in this book was at the same time that we have more diverse foods available to us, there are fewer and fewer companies providing those. So he looked at that tug and pull. And I know you guys talked a few weeks ago about that new book, Barron's, that talks about that a little bit, the consolidation of the food industry on a massive scale.
So, good.
Yeah, he really engendered that for me. And my wife and I love to eat. Everybody eats. That's probably a universal thing that we all have as humans.
And you both cook very well. I have eaten some of their food. Delicious, yeah. Delicious things.
Now, I do need to give credit to my wife for that, though. I was a bit of a garbage disposal before she and I met. I didn't think much about what I put into my body, and she made me realize that good food tastes very good. So
good.
I need to give her credit for that.
Good. Well, let's talk about the evolution of cooking. How did we figure this out as a species? And tell us about some interesting things about our journey.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. There's more and more research being done by archaeologists, anthropologists, and historians, every year. And right now, the earliest known example that we have of cooking by human ancestors is about 2 million years old at this point. So it's been quite a while that we've been messing around with fire. Now, when you look at what it might have looked like 2 million years ago or 800,000 years ago with those early human ancestors, it's very different from how we cook today. They didn't have matches. They didn't have a lighter that you could just flick. A lot of times the hypothesis is that, they would basically wait until there was a wildfire, grab a branch, and then, one of the most important jobs that early hunter-gatherer societies might have is who tends the fire, who makes sure that the fire doesn't ever go out. And so that's where we start to see the first specialization in hunter-gatherer tribes, where it's like, oh, we need to make sure that the fire is staying put. Fire has, so there's this idea called the cooking hypothesis that cooking is one of those things that really makes humans human. It's what separates us from mammals and other animals, is that we cook a lot of our foods. And cooking, it allows us to break down fibrous foods. It allows us to get more nutrients out of the foods that we eat. And so there's some evidence with this hypothesis that as humans cook their food and we're able to get more nutrients out of their food, you start to see an increase in the size of the brain, which, you know, leads to us being able to do more complex thinking, starting to see language development. There's a lot of theory with this that some of the first language development and social development happened around the community hearth. You know, a lot of that early archaeology, that's what you find. You don't find, you know, a fire in every home. You find one big community fire that people would gather around. And it's been a great wealth for archaeologists to look at those.
Yeah, the idea of discovering that you could do something with fire as opposed to run away from it, I think that's pretty darn amazing. And the importance of it,
well,
too.
Well, controlling the fire.
Controlling
the fire is where it has always been and for cooking. That's the key, right?
Let's just throw this hunk of mammoth on the fire, and we'll just see what happens. Yeah, it's true. Well, you can understand also how it's the idea of fire is something magic and sacred. That's pretty darn
and dangerous
good.
As
and
well.
Dangerous,
right?
Yeah, and
something you have to respect, right?
Yeah, when you look at go back, you know, some of our wealth of knowledge that we have about early human tribes comes from cave paintings, and one of the things that's featured a lot in cave paintings is fire. You know, depictions of fire, depictions of wildfire, suggesting that it was very important to them. It's been really interesting to see.
Well, it wasn't just for cooking, of course. It was warmth and light during the nighttime, and probably also keeping predators away.
Yes,
so it was a weapon even. Yes, many.
Yeah, and it allowed humans to do so many things that, again, make us human. And there's this great book, and I know at the end I'm going to talk more about books, but there's this great book called Catching Fire, and it's a scientific study of how fire makes us human. Fire is, whether you're lighting up your fireplace or your grill or having a big bonfire with friends, you don't think that, oh wow, I'm celebrating something that's 2 million years old in our human record.
Well, it is rather elemental.
Yes. That's a good word for it.
You mentioned, people eating cooked food, the idea of biting into a cooked bit of whether it's meat or actually being able to parch or cook grain or something, it softens it up, it changes it.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us, and then you mentioned this helped us get more good out of the food as far as our development. How is that? There's other ways it's changed us.
Yeah, there has. So one of the things that's been since the early 1960s, there's this hypothesis that when you talk about what's called the overbite versus the edge-to-edge bite. So the overbite is, you know, your lower jaw is a little bit inside of your upper jaw. So when you close your mouth, you'll notice that the bottom of your teeth touch your lip rather than your teeth touching your teeth. So the edge-to-edge bite is where your teeth would touch each other. Overbite is where your upper teeth touch your lip. And so there was this hypothesis in the 60s. C. Loring Brace, he studied skulls in Europe and in Asia, and originally he thought, oh, it looks like we can see the development of the modern overbite in the way that people ate their food. And so he had this hypothesis that, when medieval Europe switched from what's called the stuff and cut method, so that's where you would take a knife and you would stab a piece of meat on the table or a piece of whatever you're eating, and you would bring it to your teeth and you would bite it, that you had more of an edge-to-edge bite because you needed that kind of ripping motion. And when Europeans switched to forks, instead, you know, you would cut a piece of meat on your plate, bite into it, and so you didn't need the edge-to-edge bite as much because you didn't need it to do that ripping motion. And so he had this hypothesis in the 1960s that, you know, starting about 300-400 years ago when the fork was first introduced in Europe, you see that change. And he studied, he looked at skulls in Asia where chopsticks have been in use for about 900 years, and he saw that there was a bit of a correlation there as well. There's actually been some more recent research in 2019. The University of Zurich and the Max Planck Institute came out with a new study, and they wanted to test his theory as well as a competing theory by Charles pocket saying, actually, no, the overbite is older than that. And they found that, yeah, it looks like the overbite in general is about 2,000 years old. And it is when we look at the major transition from more hunter-gatherer tribes to an agricultural society where, you know, you're eating processed foods. And, you know, today we think of processed foods as something that has a whole bunch of junk in it. But processed food just means you take something raw and you do something with it. You cook it, you grind it, you know, whatever you need to do there. And so when we started switching to those softer foods, we see more and more of a correlation. So the most recent research debunked that a little bit with the 1960s hypothesis.
Yeah, we're still trying to figure this stuff out.
Yeah, we are. You know, we're
probably
always
learning. Never know definitively, but.
But when we talk about, you know, cooking is universal, one of the things that this study also found when you look at the development of the overbite is if any of you like me, I'm being very good right now because I'm on the air, but if any of you are a big fan of the F word, you can't pronounce F words and V words, they're called labiodentals, without the overbite. And so if you like me are, you know, frustrated sometimes and you like using that F word, you can thank our switch from, you know, nuts and seeds and grains as hunter-gatherers and raw meat to switching to more processed foods. Today.
Language development. Oh my goodness, so great.
Well, I'm sure the emotions were still there. They probably just had a different word.
Yes, yes. It was more P words and B words before that.
It's
about 29% less effort to create an F word or a V word with the over. They actually studied this. They modeled skulls and like, oh, how easy is it to pronounce an F word with these skulls to figure that out? It's really fascinating stuff.
Good, good. Well, let's get back to fire. And so people invented this fire stuff, and then fire became really important, and we moved into communities and households, and starting the fire was real important for a long time. Open hearths were important, whether it was in your little hut or whether it was in a big castle where you had the lord of the manor had all sorts of help.
Well, we
kitchen.
Have to remember that when the fires were in the not in the huts but in the castles, they were big. You could stand in them. You know, have different kinds of big kettles and spits and all kinds of utensils that were long handled, so that the person wielding them was not so close to the fire.
Yeah, and something that I don't think a lot of people realize either is that fires in homes predate the invention of chimneys by quite a long time.
Oh, yeah, you just have a hole in your roof.
You'd have a hole in your roof, exactly, and that was part of why, you know, fires were so dangerous in the homes, is because it was very easy. You know, when you think about
sparks flying up,
exactly.
Right? And the roofs were made out of thatch.
Yep, mm-hmm. and wooden homes, and so you can see there's been quite a history of fires, great fires, you know, burning down entire cities in some cases that were started in a hearth and just got out of control. You know, famous stories. You know, you talk about the Chicago fire. No one knows exactly how that started.
Mrs. O'Leary's cow.
Yeah, that's the popular story. Right. We don't know for sure, but, you know.
Blame it on the cow.
Yeah, I got to blame it on the cow. Yeah, and so you know, you'd have those big medieval fires with a turnspit on it, and there's actually, I can't remember off the top of my head right now, but there's actually a dog that was bred specifically to turnspits. I want to say Jack Russell Terrier, but I don't think that's right. So don't quote me on that.
Something with a short coat, I'm
yes,
sure.
Yes, yes, and it was, they would literally, they had a spot right next to the fire, and they would just walk in a circle and turn that spit so you could have that perfectly roasted pig or chicken or whatever it was that you had going over the fire.
Because you'd probably do a big thing all at once.
Yeah.
You do a cow or you do a.
And you know, and as we talk about like the slow evolution of fire in the home, you know, one of the concerns, Benjamin Franklin, actually one of the inventions that he patented was the Franklin stove. And it was, how do we make fire more efficient? Because, you know, as much as I love a big roaring fire in an open hearth at home, it is not a very efficient way to cook food. It's not a very efficient way to heat the home necessarily.
And so very
safe either. Yeah. So he came up with the Franklin stove, was, you know, kind of an antecedent to the potbelly stove, you know, contained the fire, was a little bit safer and did a better job of heating the home and allowing you to cook. And that's something that you see in the 19th century quite a bit, is it's like, how do we take fire and contain it and make it safer, it safer overall?
Because especially our European heritage, we developed a taste or any need for cooking things, and which meant keeping a fire going, or actually being able to start fire when we need it. We didn't always have lighters and matches. When did matches come about?
Yeah, so matches are a fairly recent invention. So before you had matches, as Lana mentioned, it was really hard to keep fires. One of the things that you had in the Middle Ages was called a couvre-feu from the French, and it's actually the derivative of the word curfew comes from that today. And a couvre-feu was literally just a little metal cap that you would put over your embers at night and keep them burning through the night, so that in the morning when you needed your breakfast cooking fire.
It's literally translates as cover for the fire.
Exactly. Before matches were invented, you know, you would use something like a flint. You know, some folks would have their own little tinder box that they could keep burning embers in. You could also have, if you've heard of like a matchlock musket, how those were lit was literally a wax cord that was slow burning. And they would just, someone would carry it around and light muskets at the battlefields with those. So matches, as we know them today, were an accident. There had been some earlier ones than that, but specifically John Walker, Englishman, he was trying to find a winning mix of a match that would work, and he had mixed something up. Wasn't quite sure if it would work. He had dipped a stick in it, and so he just tried to get this mixture off of that match. He rubbed it against his fireplace and it lit up, and he's like, oh wow, that was interesting, I didn't expect that to happen. And he found, okay, if I mix sulfur with sulfide of antimony, chloride of potash, and gum, I can get this first match. One of the problems, though, that you had with those early matches is sometimes they would spontaneously combust.
Oh,
and
boy.
And they used, since they used white phosphorus, he eventually replaced the antimony sulfide with white phosphorus. White phosphorus is not very good for humans. And so you actually had this rise in the middle of the 19th century with people that would pass out or die from the white phosphorus. And so they came up with what's now called the safety match. And so taking that white phosphorus and heating it up and turning it into red phosphorus, and then separating the red phosphorus from the mix on the match. And so that's where you get, you know, if you have your little matchbook today, we still use something that's very similar in a matchbook, where you've got that red phosphorus on the outside of the matchbook, and then the rest of it is
That's on the striking area.
Yeah, so the striking area is that red phosphorus. So they just separated them, and that made them quite a bit safer, and they called it the safety match because it was a lot safer.
See?
But yeah, it was only invented, the first striking match like that was only invented in the 1830s and then perfected in the 1850s. So really not that long.
Not that long ago.
Considering we've been using fire for 2 million years.
Well, you hear, I mean, when I was young and studying like Greek civilization, and they had, you know, they actually carried the fire. There was the goddess of the hearth was named Hestia, and they carried a little fire pot out to each new city state, taking their source of fire with them wherever they went.
Yep. Yeah, because again, we just didn't have a great, you know, it's just like something that most people don't realize is the modern can opener was invented 150 years after the first canned food was invented. So you know, sometimes it takes a little bit of time for us to innovate, but we get there eventually.
Important stuff. And what you gave me some reading matter here, and I enjoyed it much. The talking of cooking on a hearth, especially one, like Donna said, one of these big smoky hearth in a big kitchen, the kind that was big enough to
communal,
hold the whole,
basically, yeah,
it just huge. It required not just one person that was hungry, but it sounded like it took a whole army to create a meal. Mm-hmm. And the disparity between those at the king's table and those at the hearth or in the kitchen was quite a bit. Matter of fact, you mentioned the turnspit, the dog turning if they ran out of dogs or if the dog ran away, of course they would replace that with another cheap mode of doing it.
Children.
And children would do it, and slave children. Mm-hmm. And what an awful job, because this isn't like help me stir the pot for 2 minutes. This is like keeping it going. How long would that take to like cook a whole hog? That's like
hours and hours and hours.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was a full-time job. And so one of the other fascinating things where we talk about the intersection of cooking and language, you can see the impact of having those servants, those slaves in some cases, that were working the fires, working the kitchens. In modern English, we still have this impact, because think about the words that we use for animals that meat comes from versus the words that we use for the meat itself. So when you look at the word cow or the word chicken or the word pig, those are Germanic root words, whereas beef, pork, poultry, those are French root words. And so when you look at the history of England, you know, after the invasion of 1066, where William the Conqueror came in, you know, he was Norman, he was French. The people that were eating the meat were wealthy French-speaking nobles, whereas the people that were raising the animals that were being made for the meat were the Anglo-Saxon, the Germanic peasants. And so that's one of the long lingering effects of that division that we still have today in our language, that you see. And it's one of those ones where, you know, oftentimes, you know, we talk about, you know, history is written by the victors. History is also written by the people who have the means to write it. And for the longest time, it's only been in the last 150 years that we've had this mass, you know, democratization of information.
Peasants were not writing.
Exactly. We don't hear about the peasants that much. And that's something that I'd like to, you know, history and archaeology and anthropology are definitely working on correcting right now, is how do we tell the story of the forgotten man and woman that have driven so much of our history. But yeah, you know, you did. You would have servants in the kitchen doing everything, you know, and I know it might not be the most accurate, but I like to think of Downton Abbey as a great example, you would have your chefs and your scullery maids and your, the people that were in charge of dressing the animals. And it was a very intensive...
Well, it's a skill set that's specific, so people...
Mm-hmm.
Trained the next person to do the job, you know. It's sort of a informal educational system.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note too that a lot of the time that job was done by women as well. And so that's something that we see when we talk about the history of food in the 20th century. Is it's like, okay, how do we introduce appliances? How do we introduce various things into the kitchen that make kitchen more efficient? And that was one of the one of the unintended effects of giving women more time, so that women could do more things in there. You know, because it's like,
handy.
I don't have to sit there and churn butter all the time. I don't have to sit there and worry about how do I keep things cool. I don't have to, you know, we now have, you know, a KitchenAid. No one thinks about just how revolutionary a KitchenAid mixer is. But it is, because you don't have to stand there and do it with your hand for however long it takes to get it just perfectly mixed.
And there was a huge gap between, well, all the people moving moving to the city, and nuclear families. All of a sudden, there was mom and the kids and dad, and maybe one servant or one cook. But you didn't. But the idea of keeping fire in a stove, like you mentioned, Franklin's stove. They didn't have open fires in apartments, but there were these newfangled things that people actually kind of were afraid of to start with. The cast iron stoves mm-hmm. came in, and new technology. I don't know, we can have that. But that required a lot of work too. There was, I read about every day originally the stove had to be cleaned and blackened, whatever that means, and that didn't sound like a very time saving event there, but lots of work still, lots of work. And what I found interesting was that we have our prejudices too. Donna and I sit here and mutter about, oh, the microwave, I don't know, it just doesn't taste right, you know? and when people were moving away from meat on a spit or meat over an open fire and were given this stove.
Large iron black
thing. What in the world do I do with this? And that must have been a big transition for people.
Oh, yeah. And that's something that we see. I mean, you know, people were really resistant to it. I mean, people are still resistant to change in some ways. I mean, you know, in England, there's a lot of people that still use coal stoves, even though it's like, wait a minute, we've come up with something, you know, 100 years ago, we came up with something better than a coal stove. But, there's still a big portion of people that use them in England. The same with anything. And so it's interesting because you have, in some ways, you have this initial rush of, you know, interest among a certain set of the population in this newfangled technology. So again, like we said, talk about processed food. For the longest time in human history, processed food was seen as a sign that, oh, look, I have the money, I have the wealth to be able to process the food. I'm able to have, you know, the creamiest butter and the best sifted flour because I'm willing to pay for it. now it's completely flipped, and we think of processed food as cheap, as something that's not good.
And we want whole grain stuff.
Exactly. So we've kind of seen this switch in the last, you know, probably like 40 years where people are much less interested in processed food. Yeah, when you talk about the first microwaves coming on the market in the 1950s and 60s, and it was like, wow, this is an amazing way for us to quickly cook up food. And now, yeah, I'm like, oh, the only thing I'm willing to put in my microwave is leftovers. And even then, I'm not sure that I'm okay with what comes out of it. And
yeah,
it's just
never
that. Exactly. It's just that switch.
And one thing with this concept of processed food, well, you have to remember, people's teeth weren't so good in generations and centuries past. So having somebody chop that up and beat it up, and that was part of processing food. And it probably saved our species being able to...
Well, we have to distinguish between processed food and ultra-processed food,
which is
a big deal these days. And actually, we're doing next week's show on ultra-processed food.
There we go. See, always something to talk about. I want to take a short break here. Remind folks that this is KHOI Community Radio, and you're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking about fire in the kitchen today, how we learned to manage this amazing bit of energy, and we have been cooking for many, many, many centuries. We have been feeding ourselves for many centuries, even though this fire stuff is pretty darn dangerous. That's pretty amazing.
It's pretty handy, though, too.
And handy. We learned how to... Well, we moved from the open fires, then we then get into this cast iron stoves, and actually could cook inside. What a thing. But then there was also resistance to gas stoves. That was terrible. And then electricity came in. That wasn't that long ago that...
We skipped the coal phase.
Oh, coal!
Coal was also well, and
we don't do a lot of dung fires here in Central Iowa.
No, but that still persists in large parts of the world.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, and the estimate is that still about 3 billion, two and a half to 3 billion people cook with fire on a daily basis across the world.
Really? And there are still problems with.
And we're not talking backyard grills here.
No.
We're talking. Inside a house and breathing heaven knows what fumes, but still.
Or even
that's how we get
outside of the house. Lots of in more temperate climates, you know, the cooking goes on outside in the courtyard.
So somebody's got to gather that stuff and burn it and clean up the mess. And it's a lot of work, but we do it because we have to feed ourselves. There's roasting, grilling, frying, and we haven't even talked about baking, but that's another use of the fire, not necessarily right on the cake or right on the bread, but close to it. We've learned how to do that. And onward to all sorts of things. But there is a way to get back to cooking over an open fire, and besides being a historian, Nick Land, who is our guest today, also knows a whole lot and is a really good griller of things outside. So Talk a little bit
and
about
it. And it is grilling season, for sure.
It is.
So tell us how we can improve our grilling gigs here.
I will do my best. I do want to say I'm from Colorado, and we like to joke in Colorado that every season is grilling season. I'll share it with you guys later. I do have a photo of myself in shorts in a snowstorm out there grilling on my grill.
You would.
Yeah. And so, it's interesting because, grilling is in some ways, I feel like a returning to our past. We have, kind of like we were talking about before the break, we have this initial burst of interest in these new technologies, whether we're talking about microwaves or processed foods or things like that. And then there's always that return to the mean. And I feel like outdoor grilling is kind of that way. My wife and I love grilling, whether it's steaks or hot dogs or burgers or sausages.
Or vegetables.
Yeah, exactly. A couple of my favorites are asparagus and green onions on the grill. We'll talk about that, I'm sure, in a little bit. So grilling itself has its own little history that, when you're thinking about it, you might not think, this Weber kettle grill that I'm using has a history behind it, but it does. Everything has a history behind it. We just sometimes don't know what that history is or don't think about it.
Like to play with fire.
Yes, who doesn't like to play? I know I liked to play with fire when I was a kid. I'm sure everybody knows someone who liked to play with fire when they were a kid. And then there's some of us who never grow out of it. And in some ways, that's my job. My wife is. She taught me a lot of my grilling acumen, so I can't take all the credit. When I was growing up, it was very simple. We had a propane grill, and it was a sirloin steak. We'd marinate it in Allegro marinade, and we'd cook it to medium well, and that was how I grew up eating steaks. It wasn't until I started dating my wife early on that I learned, you can actually do other things with steak.
This story keeps coming up. It sounds like the way to a man's heart is through his stomach.
As always.
Yes,
always.
There you go.
And she, like I said, she showed me that it's okay to actually enjoy your food. You don't need to just shovel it down. It's for more than just energy. You can enjoy it.
Good.
Yeah. So you don't think about it. I personally, our household, we're a charcoal family. We much prefer charcoal over propane. I don't have a problem with propane. And there's definitely some benefits to propane over charcoal.
Yeah, it's faster.
It's faster, exactly. And a little bit more even heat sometimes. That's definitely one of the...
Anytime you got an open flame that's like from charcoal or wood chips or whatever, you have to exercise more control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's something that we'll see. But on the other hand, I'm like, I think it's worth that little bit and one of the things I do like about cooking is I feel like it's that beautiful mold of art and science. Mm-hmm. Because on the one hand, you have the science of, okay, I need to apply heat to this to get it up to this temperature.
I think all cooking is like that.
Yeah. It is. Yeah. But at the same time, it is a bit of an art, especially when you're using something like charcoal. We prefer using lump charcoal. Charcoal briquettes are great too. And a lot of people don't know that the history of the charcoal briquette actually runs through the Ford Motor Company.
Of course.
who would have thought that Henry Ford had something to do with grilling? Yeah. Charcoal briquettes. Henry Ford, when he first launched the Model T and started selling them like crazy in the 1910s, what a lot of people don't realize is at the time cars used a lot of wood in the running boards, in the headboards. A lot of the interior was made of wood.
Didn't have plastic back then.
Exactly. Yeah. Didn't have plastic or didn't use plastic because it was quite a bit more expensive at the time. It was much smaller production. One of the things that Henry Ford did was he bought forests, and they would go through and cut down the trees, mill them, and use them in the Ford Model Ts. But one of the things that a lot of people may or may not know about Henry Ford is he did not like waste. He was very efficient. That was why he came up with the moving assembly line, was how do I make things as efficient as possible? How do I reduce waste as much as possible, whether we're talking about time or money or materials? And so he worked with a real estate agent named Edward Kingsford, who told him, hey, maybe you can take some of the waste that you get from your trees, so the stumps and the branches, and do something with them. And they came up with this process where they could turn them into charcoal briquettes. They basically used a lot of different materials and glued them in. And so you can get out of one ton of tree waste, you can get about 610 pounds of charcoal when they first started, which is not terrible, not great, but not terrible. And so he would start selling In Ford model, or in Ford dealerships, car dealerships, he started selling the Ford charcoal briquettes. And then in the 1920s, he introduced his picnic kit, which came with a little charcoal grill and some charcoal briquettes.
He invented the picnic too?
he had a big, big role in it because the idea was, well, you know, I want to get more people out on the road in their cars. What's something they could do? Oh, load up for a picnic, go out, have a nice picnic, grill something up. Yeah, and he actually had a nice little saying here. I think I have it written down. Oh, no, it doesn't look like I do. But, yeah, so basically encouraging people, hey, go out, have a good time, take your Ford Model T while you're at it, you know, and go have a great picnic.
Recreational driving.
Exactly, exactly. He was a master of marketing in a lot of ways.
So you ended up with, so I suppose people were a little resistant to charcoal briquettes, but after all, coal had been around for a long time, mm-hmm. so coal and briquettes, sort of the same, not mm-hmm. quite, but...
They don't smell the same, that's mm-hmm. for sure.
No,
yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, and like I said, I personally prefer lump charcoal, which is, you know, is wood that's been, you know, and so how you make charcoal is you basically create a fire and you kind of smother it so it's a low oxygen, slow burning fire, and that's how you kind of create charcoal. And personally, I like the lump charcoal because I think it adds that really woodsy, smoky flavor that I love in the cooking that I do. But, you know, I'm not going to say I don't use charcoal briquettes. I do because, I you know, there's been some concern. People are like, well, it's not just wood that's in the briquettes, so is there some concern about chemicals or anything like that? I don't have any facts or figures about that, but I know that's been a concern.
What one could surmise.
Yes. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. But, yeah, and so even though you have the first charcoal briquettes in the 1910s and 20s, you know, backyard grilling was really not a major part of American life until the 1950s either. So there was a little bit, again, you know, you've got the invention, but it's not really.
People still had real fires in their houses.
As well, yeah. And so
it wasn't such a novelty.
Yeah, so his main demand came from smokehouses. Originally, that was where a lot of the Ford briquettes went. You know, and eventually the Ford briquettes were
sure because you can't have bacon without a
exactly
without a smokehouse
exactly. And who doesn't love bacon? And so eventually the Ford briquettes were spun off into their own company called Kingsford, and so Kingsford Charcoal, that's the original charcoal company. Yeah.
So what kind of grill do you like to use with your larger pieces of real charcoal?
Yeah, so we've got just your basic 22-inch Weber kettle grill at our house, you know, and this is definitely, you know, and if there's any grillers listening right now, they might take offense at that because, you know, you can get some really awesome grills out there, and I'm not saying
that
you can't.
Oh, yeah, those big egg things.
Yeah, the big green egg is great. Ooh. Yeah, those are Komodo grills. Mm-hmm. Those are really awesome. You've got, you know, obviously, like, your Traeger smokers. We've also got a Dynaglow that we don't really use, which
what's a Dynaglow?
It's just a company I have a Consumer Reports account, and they rated it as the top-rated charcoal grill. And I was like, okay, I'll get this one. But like I said, we use our little Weber kettle grill more than anything. And it's a lot more versatile than people realize, too. You can do more than just grill on it. We've actually smoked pork on it. You know, the pork green chili that you guys talked about last year.
Yum,
that
yum,
made,
yum.
That's how we smoked it, was on our little Weber mm-hmm. kettle grill. And the kettle grill itself has a really interesting history, too. You know, so... Early grills were just little boxes, basically. The Weber kettle grill started out as a buoy. The company that made them, George Stephen, he was an engineer there, and he was looking for a better way to cook. And so he took a buoy, he cut it in half, and then he grabbed another piece to create a lid, and he just set it up in his backyard, and he started cooking with it. And neighbors thought it was really interesting. They actually came up with a nickname for it, Sputnik, after the Soviet satellite, because it looked just like Sputnik in a lot of ways. Just this weird thing with four legs and a bowl, and started taking custom orders for it. People really liked them, and it grew from there. And now you've got the Weber kettle grill. So that's the one that we like to use. You can do both direct grilling and indirect grilling on it. Indirect grilling, like I said, since I've got that control over my heat source with the charcoal, and we use a chimney to start our charcoal because it takes less time. A chimney.
Yeah, explain what that. Yeah. That's a good invention.
Yeah, so yeah.
And it doesn't smell as bad.
Yeah, yeah. And so the chimney that we have is basically a cylinder, a metal cylinder. And you put your charcoal in it, put a fire starter at the bottom, light the fire starter, and it starts the charcoal. And because it's this long cylinder, it draws air in, and it just makes it burn faster, burn hotter. And then when it's ready to go, you pour it, create your bed of coals, and then you cook on top of it. So yeah, you can pick up a chimney. I know Hy-Vee's got them. Walmart has them. They are, if you're a charcoal griller, I know the moment we went from, oh, we're just going to create a little bundle of charcoal at the bottom of our grill to using the chimney, it was a big moment in our household, because all of a sudden it only took us 20 minutes to get our coals ready versus, 45 minutes or more.
See, the art of cooking with fire, it's fascinating, and we're still dinging around with it. It is really, really good. People have these gas grills. It kind of looks like they've taken their whole kitchen stove out. They've got knobs. They've got it. Mm-hmm. They've got wheels. They've got all kinds of things. And does that make a different product than cooking on coal or cooking on briquettes?
I think it comes down to personal preference on that one. Like I said, I prefer the taste of charcoal, but I grew up on a propane grill. That's what we used at home for that medium well sirloin that I was telling you about. And so like I said, and one of the pros and cons of a gas, gas grill is it's easier to light and it's quicker to heat up. So it's very convenient. We've all got our busy modern lives. So there's something really nice. I was like, okay, I know I just got to turn a knob, ignite it, and we're ready to go. And when you talk about gas grills, their evolution, they really haven't changed much from the first gas grills in the 1930s. The first gas grills look very similar. You've got a square box up top with your burners and a grate. And then, your space for your tank. The original, the tanks were another one where they repurposed them. Originally those 20-pound propane tanks that you see today, and I think almost all of us associate that mainly with grilling. I know there's other uses for it, but originally those were used by plumbers. And they're like, oh, well, what else can we use this for? Well, let's use it for cooking. And, so gas grills today really haven't changed that much. There's definitely been different improvements in it. So you have infrared grills. So they use gas to heat. Instead of heating your food directly, they heat ceramic tiles, which then creates...
That would give you more radiant heat.
Exactly. It gives you more radiant heat. And so, my mom, she actually upgraded from that original propane grill that I grew up on to, she now has an infrared grill. So when I go over there and I grill for her, we use an infrared grill over there. And those ones are really nice too, because the heat's in the infrared frequency, and so it's easier to control those temperatures so you can get it just right, as well as doing a quick sear on something if you're wanting something a little bit rarer on the inside but have a nice char on the outside.
Ha! Well, good. We're talking grilling trips, and we're not only cooking over your basic wood fire. We have come a long way. This is KHOI. You can find out more information at www.khoyfm.org. You can find out more about this station and more about the Donna Lana Kitchen. It's a good place to be. Kitchen grilling tips. Like Nick Land, our guest today, you can grill anytime, but a lot of us grill in the summer. So what are some grilling tips for that you'd like to pass along, Nick?
And so I've gotten these from a few different resources over the years. Like I said, my day job, I'm a marketer for grass-fed regenerative agriculture, and so I've collected these over time. So some great resources: the National Beef Council, the Pork Association. They have some awesome resources on their website that talk about these. Another one that I really like is it's called the Good Meat Project. And so not only do they have tips and tricks on how to cook, but they also have really awesome guides on how do I find good quality meat if I'm interested in buying a quarter or a half cow or a half pig. How do I find, a producer that meets my personal preferences? And then what do I do with all that meat? Because, you're talking about a lot of meat when you buy a half cow. So some of the tips that we like. So like I said, we use a charcoal grill at my house. Since that is still a fire, we are outside. It's in a contained unit. It's in that little Weber kettle grill that I was talking about just before the break. We do like to keep a bucket of water next to it just in case, because the last thing I want to do is have some sparks that blow and next thing you know, you're dealing with a grass fire. I know it's a little bit different here in Iowa, where I grow in Colorado. You know, we're very dry, and so sparks, a lot of wildfires in Colorado have been started by just a little spark. So I'm like, I'd rather play safe than sorry. As far as one of the first things that we do, so you know, we get those coals lighted and get them, wait for them to turn red hot. Once we dump those in and we put the grate down on top of it, we let it warm up a little bit, and then we clean the grate. And I actually recommend against using those specific wire bristle brushes that they sell for them. And that's because, you know, those are little pieces of metal on there, and they'll break off over time. And in some cases, you can have them, you know, end up in your food. And next thing you know, you're swallowing on a little piece of metal. So what we use is, instead we'll just crumple a ball of aluminum foil. And we'll grab our tongs and we'll scrape the grill with that. You can also use, I like the onion method as well. That's where you just take an onion, you cut it in half, and then the flat side, you put that down with some tongs and you just scrape it across, and that's a way for you to clean your grate before you're ready to start grilling. And so that's what we like to do, just to, you know, just to get it ready before we're ready to go. We'll spread the coals out a little bit too. We try to do an even bed, and we usually do about half of our grill. You know, there's only two of us, so we don't need a big roaring fire on ours when we're cooking. So we'll do it on half, and that way that also gives us, you know, some warm spots on our grill and some cool spots on our grill, because our goal is to get a really nice char on the outside but still have it be that beautiful medium rare, you know, pink in the middle.
So, yeah, is it timing, or you look and see what's going on? How do you tell when to flip things over and when?
Yeah, so and this is where the science comes into it that you were talking about, Donna. We actually use a ThermoPen 1 meat thermometer. It's an instant read digital thermometer. They're not paying me to say this. I just really like them. I think they're really awesome.
No, Nick is right. I have to say I'm old school.
Yeah.
You poke it with your thumb, and by the feel of it, you can tell. I mean, that's just an old chef's trick before the ThermoPens came along.
Yeah.
You can feel. And when it feels like medium rare is about like what it feels like when you feel the thick part of your thumb joint. You want a little give, but not too much. By the time, if it's too mushy, it's not done. By the time it's too stiff, you've overcooked it.
Yeah. And sometimes that trick, and the reason we used to do that as well, and we switched to the meat thermometer, is because some meats like grass-fed beef sometimes are more tender than that. And so I'm like, I would rather make sure that I get it just
well,
right.
Well, that is the thing about cooking with grass-fed meat, because the muscles have a different distribution of fat in them. So sometimes you have to cook them a little more quickly.
Yep.
Sometimes even a thinner cut will help too. What other things have you found for grass-fed beef?
Yeah, we like to say that it's got a bit of a, like a hockey stick on the temperature rise. So, you know, we'll still use that, but we'll notice that it's kind of a slow rise, at the beginning, and then it'll start to spike as it gets closer.
And that's when you really want to pull it off.
Yeah. And so kind of our, like if we were to break it down into what our steps are, is, you know, we'll throw the steak on the grill. And then, you know, let it spend a couple of minutes, and then we'll rotate it about 90 degrees. I know a lot of people really care about grill marks on those. Mm-hmm. We're not one of those people. We just like a nice even char on ours. But if you're looking for those perfect grill marks, you can get it just that right 90 degrees so you get the perfect crosshatch. And then we'll flip it. Usually the first time we flip it is when we'll check the temperature for the first time, see how far it is. One of the things that we'll do, especially with grass-fed meat, and America's Test Kitchen actually did a study on this and found that it was much preferred by a lot of their experts, is we'll start it from frozen, like a ribeye or a tenderloin, a fillet, something that's a bit of a thicker steak. And so how that works is we'll pull it out of the freezer, we'll let it defrost for maybe about an hour, so it's a little bit soft on the outside but still frozen in the middle, and we'll throw it on the grill, because, you know, since grass-fed meat cooks faster, that just gives you a little bit more time with it. And we found that we're able to get a really nice char, get that Maillard reaction that caramelizes the proteins, but still have a really nice red center without the gray band.
Okay, how thick of a cut would you do that with?
So we've done it on ones as thin as like an inch and a quarter. Mm-hmm. Most of the ones that we get are like an inch and a half, 2 inches. And it works really well for us on that. And it depends, you know, and part of that just came out of necessity. It was like, oh shoot, what are we going to have for dinner tonight? Oh, we need to pull some steaks out of the freezer.
Oh, that's how it
works. Oh, we didn't defrost that. And so it started with that, and then we did our research, and it turns out America's Test Kitchen said that it wasn't a terrible, terrible way to do things. So I know it's not everybody's
right.
favorite.
Well, you really have to be good with your timing on that, and your, well, if you have your,
the ThermoPen?
The ThermoPen.
Yeah.
Would help.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, without that, it's kind of hard to do that.
And yeah, it is. Yeah. So I wouldn't recommend it if you don't have an instant read digital thermometer.
But if you get one of those thermometers, then you can do all kinds of tricks.
Yeah. Right? And the ThermoPen is the most basic one they have. I mean, you can get fancy ones nowadays that have, you know, they're insertable, they're Bluetooth enabled, so you can hook them up to your phone and there's an app.
Fancy, fancy. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. You can get really fancy with your thermometers if you want. Yeah, and so we'll check it, like I said, when we do that first.
Talk about Father's Day presents coming up.
Yeah, ThermoPen would be a great Father's Day present. Absolutely awesome Father's Day present. And so then what we do is, like I said, we flip it, check the temperature for the first time, and then we'll rotate again 90 degrees for that char. If it seems like it's rising a little too fast, we might put it in the low heat section or we might bring it back. And then we like to pull ours off about 5 to 7 degrees below our desired temp. So for us,
because it goes on cooking even after you pull it out of the oven or off of the grill.
Exactly, exactly.
And they'll say in a cookbook, "Let it rest."
Exactly, and that's what it means when they say "let it rest." Is hey, it's not quite done cooking yet.
Right.
And so that's something that some of my customers will come to me sometimes. They say, "Oh, you told me that medium is 135, but every time I do that, it's overcooked." It's like, well, you got to actually pull it off at like 128.
Yeah.
If you want it to be 135. And so that's what we do. Yeah. Put it on a plate, tin it with some foil, let it rest. While it's resting, I'll douse the fire, make sure that it's out. And then we go in and we enjoy a really delicious steak. So that's definitely our favorites. I had mentioned like direct versus indirect grilling, having those cold areas. So that's something that we've done sometimes. Like if we do have a steak that's cooking faster and it can be hard to, since a lot of the meat that we get is from my job, it's like sometimes I'll have a ribeye and a chuck eye or a ribeye and a flat iron, or I'll have steaks two different steaks that take two different times to cook. And so it's like, oh, well, if this one's cooking a little bit faster, let me put it on the cold side of the grill, where it won't get as much heat. It'll cook a little bit slower. As far as, smoking on our Weber kettle grill, all we have to do for that is, you cover half of the grate with aluminum foil. You'll kind of wrap it around it on the top and the bottom. And you'll build your fire underneath the aluminum foil, and then you'll put your meat on the uncovered side, and then the little the air intake on the top of the grill, you put that over where the meat is. And so basically, as the fire's it's under that aluminum, the smoke will rise through the meat,
drawn over that
exactly
way.
Uh-huh. And so that's a way that you can smoke without having a smoker. And so, like I said, that's what we did with that pork butt that you guys had last year.
That's really good on pork.
Yeah and you know, we added some, so in addition
and
to
how
more,
long like for say a 2-pound pork butt.
Yeah, so the one that we did, I want to say it took us about 2.5-3 hours. And so we did...
low and slow.
It's low and slow. And that's what you want to do with your tougher cuts of meat. And so I like to think of, when you look at like a cow or a pig like from the side, think about it in concentric circles where the most tender cuts of meat are in the middle and then the toughest ones are on the end. So your ribs and your loin are going to be your most tender cuts. And then you've got, and people like to think that the chuck is tough, but there's actually some really tender cuts that come out of the chuck of the cow. Flat irons are great. Denver steaks. I really like chuck eyes. Chuck eyes are sometimes known as the poor man's ribeye because they're very similar to a ribeye overall, but you don't have to pay nearly the price you do at the grocery store to get a chuck eye. One of my favorite steaks. And then, you've got your brisket and your flank, and those take a little bit longer, or you have to do them a little bit differently to make sure that you're doing it right.
There's so much to cover here, and we're kind of coming to the end of our wonderful discussion here, but I want to, well, you also do vegetables on the grill. I want to ask you one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Doing corn on the grill, I think it's one of the nicer inventions. I have cooked it with the leaves on. Mm-hmm.
Shucked or unshucked, yeah.
Yeah.
Unshucked, I think. It's a good thing. I like that.
Yeah,
like
personally, that. I prefer it unshucked as well.
Because then you kind of steam it.
Yeah, exactly.
But it can get a little bit charry, a little bit interesting tasting.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really looking forward to sweet corn season. I have not yet had Iowa sweet corn.
The virtues of shucking the corn, I mean, you have to do it really quick, but you can also, you can brush on, either olive oil or melted butter with all kinds of seasonings and just keep turning it. You have to really keep your eye on it because you don't want to overcook it. But,
And I personally, for me, I'm a bit of a corn purist. I do it unshucked on the grill, and then when I do shuck it to eat it, I just do a little bit of butter and salt. That's all I like on my corn. Although I do like elotes too, which is Mexican street corn. That's very good as well.
Good. Yeah. We've had a lot of good advice here. We've been talking to Nick Land. He's a historian. He's a a marketer, and he's also
a fine grill master.
Fine grill master. Mention a few of the books that we talked about today.
Yeah, so the one of the ones that we pulled from here talking about fire was Consider the Fork, a history.
One of my favorite books.
One of your favorite books, A History of How We Cook and Eat. It's by Bea Wilson. It came out in 2012, and she just looks at common everyday kitchen items.
She has a really good chapter on fire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really, I think it's really chapter 3. Where she talks just about the history of fire in the kitchen. So it's really good because it's one of those ones.
Consider the Fork is the name of it.
Yeah, right. You don't think that, hey, everything that I use in the kitchen has a history behind it. And so that's one of the things.
Oh, boy, does it.
We learn as we go along. Well, thank you for being with us today.
Yeah.
Good. And come back. We'll have a lot more to talk
about. Yeah, absolutely.
But there's more food. There's more history. We're good. We're good. We've been talking to Nick Land about fire in the kitchen, the history of feeding ourselves. And coming up next week, believe it or not, is a fundraiser, the Weary Ramblers, a fundraiser for KHOI, which will be a concert at C.Y. Stevens Auditorium Tuesday, June 18th. Contact the station here for more information. And Donna, we have a podcast. Tell folks.
Oh, yeah. The same content that is on the radio show is available in podcast format wherever you listen to podcasts. Just type in Donna Lana. That's one word, D-O-N-N-A-L-O-N-N-A, second word, kitchen. And there we will be.
You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We come to you every Tuesday at noon, repeated at 7 p.m. on this fine station. Music by the Barn Owl Band. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
Great engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.